While you are busy enjoying your lunch, while you are busy having some times from 1300 hours, take time and listen to OTR News Bulletin.
On the radio news analysis, we go beyond the headlines. We don't just tell you what's happening. We ask what's happening, how it affects ordinary Namibians, and what it means for the country's future. We examine the structures behind news, connect policy to people's lived realities, and bring in expert voices to make sense of where Namibia is heading.
You want to get into touch with global governance, global diplomacy, economic relations, trade, statistics, human and infrastructure development, and you want to see how policy planning and policy implementation is connected in Namibia. Make time and listen to OTR from 1300 hours to 1430 with Happy Juju.
Eagle FM, the eye.
A very good afternoon, Namibia, and a warm welcome to all our listeners joining us from across the country and beyond the borders of Namibia. Thank you for choosing Eagle FM, the home of insightful conversations and meaningful national dialogue. I'm your host, Nafa Happy Juju, and this is On the Radar News Analysis, where headlines meet context. Now it's Tuesday, the 3rd of February, 2026, and the time is 2 minutes past the hour of 1300 hours. Now as Namibia moves deeper into the new month, the country finds itself at a critical juncture. Shaped by pressing questions of governance, public accountability, economic pressure, and community well-being. Now, the decisions taken during this period will not only influence short-term outcomes, but will also define the national trajectory in the months ahead. Now, right here on the Radar, we go beyond the headlines, we interrogate policy choices, examine the forces driving key decisions, and assess their real-world impact on ordinary Namibians, that is from urban centers to remote rural communities. Now, in an era marked by rapid information flow and competing narratives, On the Radar offers grounded, credible analysis, informed perspectives, and a platform for critical reflection. Our focus remains firmly on connecting national developments to lived realities. From 1300 hours to 1430, Monday through Friday, On the Radar brings you expert commentary, community voices, and journalism that seeks not only to inform but to empower. Now you can listen via all Eagle FM frequencies, stream us via the Eagle FM website, or download the Eagle FM app and stay connected through our WhatsApp channel for real-time updates, listener engagement, and exclusive content. So whether you're on the road, at work, or listening from home, stay with us as we unpack the issues shaping Namibia's present and its future. This right here is On the Radar News Analysis on Eagle FM, where Namibia meets its future. Now let's get right into today's headlines. Media personnel plays a central role in safeguarding press freedom by ensuring that the public has access to accurate, credible, and independent information. Press freedom refers to the ability of journalists and media workers together produce and distribute news without undue interference, intimidation, or censorship. Now, while operating within ethical and legal standards, while Namibia's high ranking on the World Press Freedom Index reflects a generally enabling environment for the media, the continued strength of press freedom depends largely on how journalists exercise this freedom in practice. Namibia ranks number 2 in Africa, that is coming after South Africa, and ranks number 28 globally in media press freedom. Now, of course, we're going to get hold of political analyst and commentator Ben Mulungeni so we can talk about media freedom or press freedom and what it actually means right here in Namibia. Let's just pause here for now for a short commercial break.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa Eva Tero ulikoni maondu duto ingida ashike kapeno nwe kudite opoye ekukurile oshafafa na nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuana onongeshe fa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu konda doi inawa nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshe fa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamwiri nawa ninge kwa tafanona monika ko Eagle FM onore tatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ile kumberewa Nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu batatu, o mafilane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back. Now joining us telephonically is Mr. Ben Mulongeni, political analyst and commentator. A very good afternoon to you, Dr. Ben Mulongeni, and welcome to On the Radar for the New Year 2026.
Good afternoon and Happy New Year. I believe we never met.
No, we haven't. This will be the first for 2026, but it's a pleasure to have you.
Happy New Year to all the journalists.
Oh, thank you very much. Now, today we're talking about press freedom right here in our land of the brave, considering that Namibia comes second in Africa and 28th position globally, which they have shifted from the 34th position, that is in 2024. Now, this conversation comes amidst a recent situation that happened yesterday, where a journalist was apparently escorted from the State House for asking the president a question. Now, knowing your experience in the media, Tata Ben, and of course you being a political analyst and a social commentator, kindly get into what really media itself plays, or media personnel themselves play, what role they play in press freedom.
Yes, thank you very much. Look, in as much as that we're going to make freedom, and Namibia being among the countries that got free media, that does not mean that there won't be clashes and there won't be injuries, because even in a soccer match, which is supervised by one referee in the center and four on the side, does not mean there won't be injuries. Now, that's generally said. Now, the role of the media, described by some colleagues in the West, is a watchdog. That's fine. But I've added during history or my career as a journalist and as a political observer, I have added I have seen and came to describe the other role or played by media as attacking dog, and there's some even become biting dogs. So yes, which means there are watchdogs, and some of us become attacking dogs, and others also become biting dogs. Now, the media or the journalist's job, professionalism, is about, you know, going there and look for news without hindrance. Also has a responsibility as the newsroom, responsibility to request for appointments, for interviews, for appointment, for investigative, work.
Mm-hmm.
Also, request information at any time from any office, any state house, any ministry, any agency, both public and private. But of course, that you do with responsibility in agreement with the institution or persons concerned, who also have a right to their privacy. Yes, the government is accountable, to the public, and that through the media. But the government or any institution, they normally communicate to the public through the media, through organized encounters with journalists, such as press conference, press briefing, media briefing, and also a briefing by representative of State House, representative of government, in this case, through the Ministry of Information, through the spokesperson or press secretary, and all those. But the incident at hand here, as I saw and I hear, all of us were invited to attend president meeting cabinet, and I believe it was a cabinet meeting.
Opening of cabinet for the year 2026. Yes. Official but opening.
But if the organizers, the directors of ceremony, have not made it clear that there will be questions after that. So we respect that. Or if we ask, can we ask questions? And if the, you know, the people in charge did not organize such an opportunity to avail themselves for question, they will tell us, and we respect that.
Mm.
So the case in point, I think we have to be responsible and also respect each other. I mean, the fact that we are entitled to, you know, freedom of collecting news, other people also have freedom to say, this time around, I'm not available, or I can't. And you cannot now ambush and attack, you know, on issues of you know, controversy, as sensitive they are. Of course, for me, as a journalist, I don't think there's a sensitive issue when it comes to public interest. There shouldn't be. But of course, in a government, in a country, there are some sensitive issues.
Mm.
Also, kind of provocative questions. No, perhaps a journalist could have done proper research and investigate and come back and say, look, we have information about this and this and this and this and this. And or if you are refused, you know, to post questions, you can send your questions through responsible personnel to State House and say, I want an interview, a lengthy interview, and you have questions based on the information you have received, or based on your research, or based on your investigative journalism. Personally, my take is that it looks like these questions, I'm not saying it is, but it sounds like it came from a rumor or gossip or hearsay or assumptions, or we hear or it says they are saying there are some people involved in this and that. I have not come across any reading or any writing that indicate that there were thorough investigative journalism, you know, undertaken to say, look, we really, this really warrants us to aggressively pursue this issue. I saw today when the president, you know, issued brief information rejecting allegations. Now, well, if we are not happy, we can do investigations. Nobody will stop you from, you know, carrying out your investigation journalism. Now, if you get arrested, I'll condemn that. I'll protect you.
Mm.
If at that incident people are saying, no, please, please, we have not prepared any media briefing. We don't have a press conference. Why don't you just, you know, agree and say, oh, sorry, we wait later.
Yeah.
We have to learn to respect the responsible citizens. Mm. We are not only us, but we are human beings, responsible citizens to respect others' view also. Not only our views, but other people too have their opinion and views.
Mm, correct.
It's right to say no for now.
Tata Ben, let's pause here for a few seconds just to allow room for a commercial break, and we'll be back to continue.
Thank you.
Okay. Listeners, please do stay on the line.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud. So
not a fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity?
Spend less and get more with budget beaters at WB. Get a 2-liter Rietfontein juice for only $36.99. 5 kg nice rice for just $87.99. 4 kg Kadila chicken portions for $189.99. And 2 kg sunlight hand wash powder for only $57.99. See more month-end specials at vurmanbrock.com. We care.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not...
Okay. And we are back. Tata Ben Walangani, are you still there?
I'm here.
Thank you so much. Now, an interesting, curious question I have on my mind is that I hear some people commenting to say the president had the journalist thrown out of the State House, so to say, or had her removed from the State House. And I'm thinking to myself, is it really the president? You know, there are times certain things are done and security or personnel jumps in and does something without even being told by the next person. Educate us on that, in that aspect.
My experience and what I know, you must know that each office in the presidency or in government, they got personnel, staff trained to do certain work, and they are not trained by the president. Mm-hmm. And even when you get into a position of responsibility, others may say of power for that matter, it's not your business to tell the security apparatus what to do, the security, the commanders what to do. They are trained separately. They are trained specifically to watch and observe movements and situations. Actually, they are the one to tell the president what to do.
Mm.
It's so obvious. It's really naturally so. You don't need to be told, because the president is a president. And the police officers, whether the commanders or security officers, they know what to do. They don't even, sometimes I've seen they even go against the president's approach. Because they say, because they advise us. How many times us in the public, my journalists for that matter, to say, where are the advisors? There are cases when we question, not the president, but his advisor, if they are there.
Mm-hmm.
What are the advisors? And the advisors are starting from Prime Minister, Deputy Prime Minister, Vice President, other ministers at various sectors. And that security sector, it's totally independent sector. And I don't agree, and I would not agree even if I was not there. I'm here now in Oshakati. I've seen myself, even in my own life, security, they tell me, look, doctor, when you come here, you must tell us that you are here. Don't just pop up in a region, you know, and you don't tell us. You know, we are also to take care of your life or your whatever when you are in a responsible position. So it's a misunderstanding or lack of knowledge or maybe illiteracy, to say the hard word, or in that matter. I mean, I don't believe the president will say, yes, there are cases when it went to West. Some of us, when our secretary to the House of Parliament, I tell the speaker that this person must go out.
Yeah.
Or this person is going beyond the prescribed, you know, protocol or beyond the rules. I give you an example. If a member of parliament make a statement that is outside, you know, the prescribed time or does not fit in the open debate, like there are debates where you only concentrate on the bill. There are debates where you have to say anything, particularly when it comes to budget. But as a secretary to parliament, with the security, I have a right to say, Mr. Chairperson, it's time to call in the security to take this action.
Mm.
Based on the book that is there, there are rules, there are protocols. And here I will go in defense of the president to say, well, I was not there, but I want to say, generally, the security can take action without even asking the president. Sometimes even going against the president's wish.
Interesting. Dr. Ben, how does a journalist and one who wants to aspires to be a good journalist with moral values and ethical values strike a balance between being bold and also being proactive? How does one strike that balance?
I want to advise that sometimes as journalists, we get carried away by the, you know, seeking fame, perhaps, to be seen to be brave. You know, sometimes there are situations where, or there are mentality that if a journalist has never been to jail, you are not a journalist. Of course, you never have been a journalist in jail, yeah? I mean, people want to be heroes. Then, you don't have to force matters to an extent that you will be seen like you have a personal interest in it. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
Professionalism requires that you must be seen to be neutral. even your question should not sound that you have a personal agenda or a personal, you know, event or something like that, that today I'm going to, you know, today I'm going to ask, today I'm going to force. You don't have to force. Professionalism, there's no force in professionalism. Yes? If you have been refused many times a chance, you must tell us.
Yeah.
But a chance that is there, availed, that we know. Press briefing, send question 4 times, 5 times to State House or to the ministry, and you don't get a response. Let us hear that, and we can protect you.
Interesting.
And it's also a code of ethics. I don't think it's ethical to bulldoze or attack. I don't think so.
Mm.
Because you are, there's also an element of abuse. We cannot also abuse our power and responsibility, our power as journalists. I know we are powerful, but you should not abuse that power. Equally, of course, the president cannot abuse the power. Nobody must abuse the power.
Indeed. Now let's take a look at a case study, perhaps of America. We do know that there were times when the press, the time when U.S. president was set to go against Vice President, at the time when they were to be elected, where the press and the media were reporting negative, which was kind of like obvious to somebody who has been following, deliberately reporting negatively against Donald Trump, obviously to make him to lose the case or to lose, not to win, to become president for America. Just that media itself and having the tool or the power to cause a propaganda. Get into an extensive explanation for us on what media can actually do and some of those basics terminologies that media can also use. I know it can also use emotions, words, sensations, and that kind of stuff.
Listen very carefully here. The media institutions and journalists themselves individually, they are not from Mars or Jupiter. They are not from another planet.
Yeah.
Human beings, just like individuals in society. Of course, you cannot rule out or deny the fact that each one of us has got a position on every topic or on every issue or on any candidate. That's just human. But the question is, the difficult task is that which I've been preaching, mm-hmm. in as much as you got preference, you must give people equal chance. You must not use your personal preference or personal choice, you know, to disadvantage or to favor your candidate. And that's the difficult task now. Some people cannot. Some people become emotional. It's the same as I seen one police officer when attended a party meeting. And when they were performing the party anthem, he also raised his fist up. It's ignorance. You can't. You are a police officer. You cannot show your rights to them. You came there to attend a meeting in as much as you are senior as a police officer in case there will be violence or there will be maintain peace and order. And also as a journalist, you are supposed to report factual as they is. But then, remember, propaganda is reflected in the media more than any other place.
Indeed.
So some media outlets or media institutions, media houses are run by people who are members of Party A or Party B or support of Candidate A and Candidate B. And during the heated up, you know, debate, they could not hold but try to reveal all the negativity, all the negative news, historical facts or, you know, perceived to be facts and incidents against the hated or the candidate they don't like. I don't like it. Unless you are there in a specific boardroom, specific propaganda laboratory, where you cook propaganda specifically aimed at tarnishing or destroying the other candidate. But if you are there as a journalist to report, that's what we don't support. We don't respect journalists like that. But it must be clear, like, you are not in the business today or this time around as a I'll give you an example. If I get hired by any party of my choice,
yeah,
I will stop reporting. I will go to the laboratory of propaganda, mm-hmm. assist from not in the open laboratory of propaganda. Yes. So, but yeah. if you decide or you're chosen now to be an equally, if I'm already in the laboratory of propaganda, so obviously, it will be difficult for me to come out and do reporting because I'm already being seen associated so closely with the candidate. Because what you report or write or analyzing, how credible would that sound to other people? You say, no, no, what do you expect from Happy? She's already, you know, in the campaign. You must take one. Either you campaign or you do, you know, analytical reporting. To be credible, and that's one to educate my younger journalist. Choose one. Otherwise, if you report, before I read, I say, oh, this name, this one, I don't expect any objectivity here. So if you want to fight for your, you know, career as a journalist, you avoid that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are people who do that. Some people are paid to do that. Some media are paid to do that. Some newsrooms are paid to do that. And I've seen it in my lifetime. I've seen even people being paid by different candidates from the same party in my own newsroom. So, yeah, I'm talking from the experience.
Yeah.
And I even confronted some candidates, please, you are the one causing trouble in the newsroom because you have your good voice there. And the other one got his blue-eyed voice there. I told some of my comrades. So this I'm sharing with you.
Indeed. Now, Dr. Ben, lastly, let me ask you to speak to us about the danger of turning a media house into a gossip column. You know, it's now, you speak about some journalists being paid, you know, to sort of like advocate for a certain particular, news or, you know, certain, angle. Now, what about a whole media house where you can see that it's moving away from professional journalism to becoming sort of a gossip column where what the reaction of people is more important or more credible than what we actually put out there, and how media houses can guard themselves from such?
It's very difficult. Remember, in my theory on media, there is no independent media house. There's never one, and there will be never one until the end. Why? And I can challenge anybody who says it's independent because, for example, and I've been debating that. I wrote an article some years ago, and I debated on TV, NBC, where we met together with editors. He was editor of the German community of the newspaper. For example, if you are a journalist writing for a Catholic newspaper, obviously you will not write anti-Catholic articles.
Indeed.
If you are hired by a Lutheran, like now there is the Elsin issues between the bishops, you cannot write in that newspaper and being engaged in, you know, writing stories about corruption.
Yeah.
Fire you. If you are, and I challenged my colleague, whom I know so well, he was debating with me, there's no media freedom. They thought it's only government media that are controlled, that are undemocratic. But I say, look, you are editor of the German newspaper. Can you write something that is kind of against the German community, Namibia's interest? You can't. They'll fire you. There was a case, I remember, I don't forget things. There was a case when an American cameraman was fired the day after he filmed President George Bush, vomiting on the Japanese prime minister. We don't forget that. He's fired next day. How can you, you know, embarrass our president? And that is from America, the heart of democracy and media freedom, so-called.
Mm.
You can't. So, but the question is, somehow to balance, try to be seen to be neutral. Not even those so-called independent media, they cannot be independent. How can they not be independent? Because the owner belongs to certain interest group in society. The owner, even the initiator, is a friend to certain business groups. What if he's a business person in the oil industry or in the fishing industry? And you write an article against their interests that will cost them billions of dollars. Do you think you write that? Because every newspaper, in as much as belong to Ben, or every radio, in as much as belong to Happy, somehow, somewhere, in one way or the other, is being supported by some business guys,
yeah,
or church guys, or religious guys, or other friends in some corridors of power. Then you cannot tell me somebody will be independent. There's independence, total independence, absolute independence. There isn't. I repeat, there's no absolute independence in the media. Never.
Interesting. It's always a pleasure learning from you, Dr. Ben. But your closing remarks on this quite interesting conversation, and I think I want you to leave us with a few pointers to the journalists themselves. And I think this conversation is particularly meant for them. This discussion is particularly meant for them. Things that we ought to do or not to do to ensure that Namibia continue to rank a number two in Africa in terms of press freedom, even probably soon coming up to number one and moving from 28th globally to coming up to, because really we do enjoy press freedom right here in Namibia. You know, I tell you what, when I was at the State House yesterday, I mean, you're in the same room with ministers, you're in the same room with the prime minister, you're in the same room with the president, just a few inches from them. Is this something that really other journalists get to enjoy in other countries? Let's talk about Nigeria, for instance, where an ordinary citizen cannot even come so close to the president or say, or much less to even write an email to say, I would want to see the president, and you can have it done. So it's something that I believe we are indefinitely enjoying press freedom right here in Namibia, but we wouldn't want to pee on that press freedom. Yeah. But yeah, your last take on that.
I think you are right. I've seen it. You are not the first person to tell me about yesterday. I also spoke to different journalists who called me for advice that they were there and they are happy with the situation. Namibians, we are very unique because some years ago, you can find a minister deep in kabashus, having a drink with ordinary people, including journalists. Journalists were not feared. They were not monsters in the eyes of politicians. But remember, this media freedom can only be maintained if there is some mutual respect between journalists and politicians. Let me say politicians to be, you know, concrete. And also other people in the public. There are private sector there. I mean, if you just a manager of Coca-Cola or brewery or manager of a big private company, white owned, you just force Mr. Van der Merwe and attack him with a question. Who will not?
No.
Who will blacksmith you away? He said, I'm not ready. You can't. I know. Because I used to send journalists to look for articles somewhere in the private sector. No, they'll chase you away. They'll push you security, chase you away. Just because of government. I mean, let's not show as if the government is our enemy. We are just as they are. Let's not show as if we got a vendetta or an agenda. We shouldn't. But of course, we must be fearless. We must be bold in looking for information. It must be provided. In that way, we also can say, look, it was fair or it was unfair the way we were treated. It's fair that you must continue to ask for questions on the pertinent issues of society in the interest of the larger public. I'm not sure whether the people out there in the villages will agree with you just to attack a president with a question when he said, no, I'm not prepared today. I mean, we cannot use force.
Yeah.
You are abusing. You are abusing the poor person. No, we must respect and act responsibly for us to be respected also.
Indeed. Absolutely.
Yes.
Dr. Ben Monongene, thank you so much. I always learn something thank whenever you. We engage. I do appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And they had it from political analyst and social commentator Ben Mulongeni. Sincerely, I always learn something, one or two, when we engage with him, especially on topics of where he has to give his analysis. Now, coming back to media personnel playing a central role in safeguarding press freedom. Now, one of the primary responsibilities of media personnel is to act as watchdogs of power, as you had Mr. Ben Bonogeni speaking right there, by holding government, public institutions, and private entities accountable. Now, through investigative reporting, that is something that has tangible proof to it and not just something that we blatantly speak out without having evidence to it, and critical questioning, journalists expose corruption, maladministration, and abuse of authority, ensuring transparency and accountability in a democratic society. Now, this role helps protect the public interest and reinforces trust in democratic institutions. But then again, caution, wisdom is profitable to direct, you know. There should be a time, and I want to say wisdom is knowing when to do a matter, when not to do it, when to withhold, when to retaliate, when to, it's about guiding yourself and giving yourself principles as a journalist or even in life in general, when to actually react on a particular matter and how to react in a particular matter. You know, there's also a thing about how you treat certain people, not being biased per se, but obviously the way I'll probably treat an elder in my village, it's not the same way I'll treat a young person that I meet, or my fellow age mate that I meet probably in the city. It will be completely different. So I think we need to know when to apply a particular thing and how to apply it, when to do this. And, you know, you study the environment as well. So as to say, is this appropriate for me to do right now or perhaps not? Now, this role helps protect the public interest and reinforces trust in democratic institutions. Media personnel also contribute to press freedom by providing accurate, you know, not getting our emotions involved, verified and balanced information. It's very needful, something that I have, as I have been trained, you know, to work on Eagle FM right here. In the very beginning of my career right here on Eagle FM, I was trained to say happy if you're going to report on a school that apparently dumped rubbish in somebody's yard. It's very necessary that you don't just listen to the person, the owner of the yard, telling you that they dumped refuse into their yard, but also get hold of the school. So have two sides of the story and listen to both of them and hear the matter and report. Factually, don't take sides with a person, for instance, whose yard refuse was dropped into. Now, this is also the need for fact checking. A clear distinction between news and opinion should be there, and avoidance of misinformation are essential to maintaining a credibility. Now, when the public trusts the media, press freedom is strengthened. Yeah, as society is more likely to defend a media sector it views as responsible and reliable. I read that again. Or repeat that again. When the public trusts the media, press freedom is strengthened. As society is more likely to defend a media sector it views as responsible and reliable. And I tell you something. There are times when I've gotten hold of guests, you know, potential guests to engage on the radio. And they, I've heard them personally say, oh, which media house did you say you are again? And I repeat to say Eagle FM. And they will begin to say, they will come in to say, okay, since it's Eagle FM, you're one of the trusted media houses, you know. We don't go about, I think, carrying sensational news. You're factual and not opinion-orientated. So I'll be interested to do that. What does that point to you? It shows you that society is more likely to trust a particular media house which holds itself in a particular accountable manner, opposed to another media house which may give itself as a sensational news outlet or a gossip column. I like to give it like that, to say it bluntly out like that. So it's important. As much as you may sometimes gain followers, you might lose public trust in the long run. And not only that, you might have people not wanting to be involved in what you're dealing with, in the media that you're running. They might not want to be involved. Why? They are scared that you might twist their words. So it's very necessary to remain factual, to remain original to what the intended story or the initial story was. Now, another key role of journalism is to give voice to diverse perspectives, including those of marginalized and underrepresented communities. By reflecting a wide range of experiences and viewpoints, the media ensures that press freedom benefits all citizens, young, old, in between, not only those in positions of power. Now, this inclusive approach helps connect national policy decisions to lived realities across the country. And as I read about lived realities across the country, it reminds me of what the president spoke about yesterday as she was addressing her cabinet, to say that they must, the cabinet themselves, they must be able to align themselves with lived realities across the country. I'm paraphrasing it now because, yeah, not exactly that way, but yeah, she spoke about lived realities of the people, you know, of the Namibian people. In other words, decisions and policies somewhat that are attached to lived realities, not the fairy tale of things, but the actual experience of what people are experiencing on the ground. Namibian personnel also expected to maintain editorial independence by resisting political, economic, and commercial pressures that may influence reporting. Again, something that Tata Ben Molongeni was also speaking about. You know, there's a need for independence as a media personnel, as a reporter, as a journalist, as a radio presenter, as a TV presenter, you know. Now, upholding ethical journalism standards such as fairness, respect for human dignity, and responsible reporting further protects press freedom. Now, as unethical practices can undermine public confidence and invite restrictions on media operations. Ultimately, press freedom exists to serve the public's right to know. Journalists act as a bridge between decision makers and citizens, enabling informed public debate and participation. Now, in Namibia's context, the continued defense of press freedom depends on journalists remaining professional, independent, and accountable, ensuring that the freedoms guaranteed in law are sustained through responsible media practice. And with that, let's pause right here now. We'll be back shortly.
Lipura nengeno wapungwa eva tero ulikoni maondu tuto ingida ashike kapeno nwe odite opoye ekukulile oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano hile koshuala onongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka okukwetira oipindi konu kwa ndado ilinawa nune udo otukwetira o special angeta shake ngeshe faa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nukumona oijamo ilinawa ninge Fanona, Monica, Co, Eagle FM, Honora Tatime, Bali Hairi, Nola Natu, Hairi Bali, no hair, Ileco, Berewa, Nora Hetatu Natu, Bali O Hetatu Batatu, Oma Felane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Now, in other news, let's move over to Rundu. 35 years, but before that, let's just make room for a scheduled commercial break and we'll get into it.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually to put it in my.
Why pay more when you can pay less at USAID stores? 4 kilograms of real good frozen mixed chicken portions for only 199.99 Namibian dollars. 10 kilograms of champion super maize meal, only 104.99 Namibian dollars. Wellington tomato sauce, just 25.99 Namibian dollars. And pay 194.99 Namibian dollars for 1 liter Bonita long life milk. You save where good food costs less.
Out fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have a capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the
eye.
35 years after independence, residents of Ngwangwa village in the Rundu urban constituency say they are still living without access to clean drinking water. Now, approximately 400 residents living in the village claim they continue to endure inhuman living conditions despite being located within an urban constituency, pardon me. Now, community members say they are forced to rely on dirty pond water infested with worms and insects, a situation they claim has led to cases of diarrhea, sores, and other bacterial infections, with many residents frequently seeking medical treatment. Residents further complain that the absence of proper access roads prevents taxis from reaching the area, making it difficult for community members to access healthcare services, particularly during emergency. They say the situation leaves them feeling neglected 35 years after independence, questioning how some rural communities have access to clean water while they are left to consume contaminated water within an urban setting. Now, the community is now calling on town councillors and the Rundu Town Council to urgently intervene and provide clean water and other basic services. Eagle FM contacted Rundu Town Councillor Andreas Jikera for comment, and he said he was unable to comment on the provision of basic services affecting residents of Ngwangwa village. However, he indicated that the relevant councillor is expected to hold a community meeting on Wednesday to engage residents on the matter. My colleague Anakleta Haikera picked up this particular news, and let's now take a listen to Festus Matunga, one of the village development committee. But before that, let's listen to Anakleta Haikera. She tells you more on this.
My name is Anakleta Haikera, Eagle FM Rundu. Now, for the past 35 years in Rundu, residents say they still drink water and travels on broken roads. Now, a recent visit to Ngwangwa resident in the Rundu urban constituency, about 400 people living in Ngwangwa village in the Rundu urban constituency say they continue to live in inhuman condition despite being with urban boundaries. Community members say they are forced to rely on dirty ponds water infested with worms and insects, which they claim has resulted in diarrhea, sores, and other bacterial infection, with many residents frequently seeking medical treatment. Speaking to some of the residents, they complain that the lack of proper access road prevent taxis from reaching the areas, making it difficult to access health services, especially during emergency. And one of the residents had this to say.
So, as I'm using presenting in our society for the problem that we are complaining for so long yet. So we are complaining about the water that we are facing, and we are complaining this issue to the councillors. But since we have taken our problem to the councillors, still we did not receive any response to them. So since this, like, if we can look at this, how water is like still looking, but we say that Ngwangwa is in town. So how can it's like town people drinking like the water like this, but rural people, they are drinking health people, but we are saying that Ngwangwa town is in town, but see the town people, the water that they are drinking. So how can, what is the health of this water looking like that? How is the health to the people? So, but if we can see how like councillors or town councillors, how they are buying the mind of people during election, they are coming telling people lying, they are lying people.
You know, Johannes Chalimuna, another member of the Village Development Committee, says the only visible development achieved in Gwangwa Village to date is the footbridge constructed in 2023 by Minister James Sankwansa before he assumed his current ministerial position. Chalimuna has further called on the minister to visit Gwangwa Village to personally witness the difficult conditions faced by residents. He stressed the urgent need for access to clean water and proper roads, saying thus remain the community's most pressing challenges. Let's take a listen to Johannes Chalimuna.
Okay, yeah. First of all, let me say thank you, the Eagle FM team, and I thank my minister, Honorable Sankwansa, for constructing this bridge for the residents of Gwangwa. It's only him who heard our cry, and he came to rescue us from our problem. But all the officers of those who are like talking when it comes to campaigning for their position of becoming councillors and governors and everything, so they still did nothing for our village since independence. Now this is the 36 years of independence. In Gwangwa, we are receiving nothing from the government side. It's only Sankwansa who came and used his own pocket money and construct for us this bridge which you are seeing now, where we are at least crossing and reaching to other services which are closer to town. But our cry is that we are Namibian, like those who are in the offices, but we are receiving nothing from the government. Our water is not consumable because we are like sharing with animals. Cattle they drink, humans they drink. So when it comes to people's health, so these are the basic needs which we also need in Gwangwa. We need water, we need proper road structure, since we are all Namibians. So sometimes you ask yourself that why are we cut off, as we are not part of this country. So we are not receiving any services. The town council, they have forgotten us. Even to make it worse, the town council, they were given to like engineer this bridge, but they failed us. Yeah. Even minister himself, Mr. Sankwansa, or Honorable Sankwansa, is very much aware about this bridge. So that something did not go well. And even now, we are still calling him. Since that time when he came and hear our cry, he was just a member of this country. Or he was the former minister of information and technology of broadcasting, but now he's a minister of urban and rural development, so he should get this information that we still need him down here at Gwangwa, so that maybe he can push those who are in the Rundu offices, in the Rundu urban offices, Mr. Sankwansa, to receive this information, so that you can tell those who are in the offices of Rundu urban and the mayors and everything, everyone in the office, to come down to Gwangwa and come see to our problem. So, not even to come see our problem, because they are very much aware. They know our problem already since 1990 up to today. So some of us were born here, but we are getting old, not getting to any services or any basic services, drinking dirty water every day. So no proper road. We are struggling. Sick people. It's hard for us to get them to the nearest services. So even at night, so criminal activity now, they are at a high. So crossing at night without a proper protection from other the neighbors or whoever. So you will not reach the tire road. So they will just attack you here. People are being attacked through this road getting to the tire road. So we are calling the ministry, especially now Honorable Sankwansa is the Minister of Urban and Rural Development, to come to our rescue here at Gwangwa. We are really in a deep situation. We are tired of crying to the officers, the councillors, the mayors, who even the former councillors, they left this problem in the office. So we don't know why. We don't know why we are left out. But I thank for those who hear our cry and the response to our problem.
And lastly on this, let's also take a listen to Maria Hakusembe from that particular area, Gwangwa Village.
Womema, kuveta mama topengo no imbumburu tatu damna tatu litwiki wakala mono mvura usiwale kaya apasa abnanguru kasumungu setu wanona simpe norube joru kwa tolichinju mworo la kansela wata ni muretere mema kansela kapatupe mema vayatu mborora zombora kwa azi mborora 2025 dogoronge sidata zikaranye 2 years kwato mema yotwa kunikanya ko totate meya muka tupulire ko watu mborore no sebatu penye mema nare bagambora mbora katazikara ngwe ndisi uwo sebazi mborora ngoso mo mo processi mozili nare nga watu ira nonda mano se kumeko mema gomawa mema makumona nge sina genyaga gahanzere mo makumona se mema yo idonatu akunwa condition okay. Tukumo mzatara okay. Ngesi okay. Gahanzere mema zanawe tu ngororo bakunwa marosa simo ndangozo doro patwa kala kabisa kutuli kitato se mondangozo doro patwa kala wakwa tuwakala mama uiza marakwa kukaruka na wakwa kunwa nawa ose tuwa kulitumbura simo ndangozo doro baga mema gahanzere ngesi iko tuwa kuna nda hii mbumburu mwai mwone yei gihaya kara ngesi hey. Ngoro tuwa kuinwa ngoro tuwa kuparuka watu fire konkendo hao wakwa tu tate meya ndio government ndi town councilor no se va tu dioro ke como mpunda gwangwangwa.
And with that, let's pause right here and take a trip to the marketplace. Of course, you know, we'll be back with News Beyond the Borders right after that. Do stay tuned right here on Eagle FM on the Reading News Analysis. Now, should you be interested also in posting your question or perhaps sharing your contributions with us, please dial in on 083-288-401. That is 083-288-401. We'll see you after the commercial break.
The views and opinions expressed by our guests and callers are not those of Eagle FM and any of its staff.
Wapumbwa Eva Tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku tete opoye ekukulile. Oshafa fana nongeshe faili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshuala. Nongeshe faa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano. Okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna evi tota njuka. Okukwetira oipindi konu kwa ndado inawa. Nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshe faa omarudi. Dayo loka opone ushendi fenawa nokumona oijamwiri nawa ninge pata fano na Monica ko Eagle FM onora esatu imwe bali heali nola natu heali bali no heali ileko berewa mura hetatu natu bali o hetatu watatu o mafelane Eagle FM the eye.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
So, not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6%. Is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Lena's at.
Welcome back now for News Beyond the Borders of Namibia. Let's start off in South Africa, where they are hosting the presidential summit and promoting sustainable solutions for human settlements.
Human Settlements Department is today hosting the Presidential Summit of Innovative Building Technologies. It's a gathering that's expected to last over 2 days at the NASRIC Expo Center in Johannesburg. This event aims to advance and showcase innovative, sustainable, climate resilient and scalable construction solutions that support dignified housing and eradication of informal settlements around the country. Watching the story is SABC News reporter Nosipho Radebe, who's live to us now from NASRIC in Johannesburg. And Nosipho, we have spent decades in this country reporting about just how long the housing backlog in the country is. I imagine it's issues like that that are likely to be ventilated where you're at.
Certainly, Ayanda, very good morning to you and to the viewers at home. We did hear, of course, from the minister earlier this morning, just outlining some of those issues, pointing out how we do, of course, have a housing backlog in South Africa and how many families have waited years just for some affordable and safe housing. And, of course, looking then at low-income earners, middle-class households, and how we can then alleviate the burden when it comes to safe and affordable housing in that segment. But we'll also look at include rural housing as well, because, of course, as you point out, climate change is an issue. And, of course, having then safe and affordable housing is something that will be top of the priorities for the experts that are gathered here today. But I'm going to turn to my guest, the Deputy Minister of COGTA, Dickson Masemola, just for some insight on this. A very good morning to you, Deputy Minister. Thank you for your time. I guess as COGTA, maybe let's get your perspective around the importance of this Innovative Building Technology Summit.
Well, we are here to participate in this important summit convened by Human Settlement Department and the Minister in particular, precisely to come and be looking at alternative technologies and ways and means through which we could be able to provide better housing infrastructure, mindful of the fact that climate change and as well as inclement weather that comes with very destructive realities. And therefore, this meeting is very important in our view because it's a confluence of South African minds from all walks of life to come and have a national conversation on how best we could package alternative housing delivery mechanisms that will basically make it possible to give climate resilient infrastructure both in urban areas and as well as many parts of the country in our rural provinces. So it's a very important meeting of minds of all South Africans, probably as well also from many professionals, engineering, architectural, skills that will be, sharing perspectives on how best working together with the Human Settlement as local government, we could be able going forward to provide those better infrastructure for housing, because South Africans are basically, experiencing serious problems in many parts of the country as a result of the contemporary environmental realities that have been brought about by climate change. But not only that alone, but also the need to basically find better ways to house them, because urbanization in many parts of the country has really become an unavoidable phenomenon, which is a global matter. And to the extent that people are going closer to urban centers, unavoidably, it has resulted in the housing needs. In as much as in rural areas, equally important, people who are struggling financially, economically, they as well deserve to be housed much better. And this meeting, in our view, and that is the reason why we are participating as the Department of Local Government together with housing, so that we can have integrated approaches from funding, from planning, and as well as from implementation, so that together we can be in a better position to influence the policy options on how South Africa as a government could well handle this issue of housing South Africans.
And as you point out, Deputy Minister, of course, there's this push then for many people to move to urban areas. But of course, you've pointed out that you're not leaving out then rural areas. Can you just give us sort of an indication of how you plan to overcome some of the challenges that are presented when it comes to rural housing?
Well, I think to the extent that we have been able to pass a policy through Human Settlement on provision of housing infrastructure in rural villages, we having what we call a urban development program. Okay, firstly, there is what we call integrated urban development framework as a policy response to many problems that are basically experienced in urban areas, to the extent of democratizing a spatial governance and be able to deal with all those realities around spatial planning. But in particular with regard to rural areas, we are having serious discussions together with our municipalities and as well as district municipalities with regard to the extent to which we can be able to roll out a massive infrastructure development. And of course, I think you are quite aware that His Excellency, President Ramaphosa, in the past few months has been able to articulate a massive infrastructure rollout program, which he says we're going to be spending almost R1 trillion in the next coming 3 years. And that money has been allocated to various departments, including even our department as COGTA. And for us to be able to provide housing to our people in villages, in peri-urban areas, including urban areas. We are going to be actually utilizing those resources for infrastructure provision in terms of basic services, layout of infrastructure in areas where municipalities would have been able to identify them as places for human settlements, and therefore provision of basic infrastructure, it becomes a necessity so that top-up structures can be easily be constructed by human settlement. So the integrated approach and management within the context of collaborative leadership between ourselves and as well as human settlement. Resources, to the extent that His Excellency has announced that, for me, it does not necessarily become a major constraint. I think the biggest issue, which is a threat on our side, which is what we're dealing with, it's spatial planning, so that working together with our traditional leaders in those villages, in those peri-urban areas, we can be in a better position to have a better alternative means with regard to land administration, land access, so that better planning can be actually done, so that we don't see our people being settled in flatline areas where when these floods, when they come, it becomes very pathetic because people get subjected to difficult conditions as a result, in many instances, of them having been settled in wrong places. Now, if you were to put massive housing infrastructure in a floodland area, you can see you'll just be subjecting our people to unavoidable difficulties. So this process that we're here for today of this important summit, it will be to look at all those alternative models so that where we are supposed to settle people in villages, in rural areas, together with traditional leaders and municipalities, we must survey those places and see that they are suitable for settlement, in as much as in urban areas equally important. The metros, the town councils, they would also have to make it possible that where they identify land, those places are suitable for human settlements, and therefore planning and design becomes very paramount. And this summit for us, it's a very important meeting of minds. Like I said, a confluence of engagements going forward to develop those mechanisms and alternative models of providing housing infrastructure.
All right. Thank you so much, Deputy Minister. That was the Deputy Minister then of COCTA, Dixon Masimola, just outlining then the importance of the summit for COCTA as a department, and also just one of the issues that they plan to deal with, that of spatial planning and how it affects then housing in South Africa. But for now, Ayanda, it's back to you in studio.
Nosipho Radebe, live to us from Nasrec in Johannesburg. Thanks very much indeed.
Meanwhile, farmers in South Africa have taken the government to court over foot and mouth.
Now, the management of South Africa's worst foot and mouth disease outbreak has escalated into a legal showdown between the Minister of Agriculture, John Steenhuisen, and a coalition of private agricultural lobby groups. Agricultural interest groups, along with lobby group Sakelege, are launching legal action against Steenhuisen for his alleged failure to justify a ban on private foot and mouth vaccinations. For more on this matter, we are now joined by Sakelege CEO, Pitt LaRue. Pitt, a very good morning to you, and thanks so much for joining us.
Morning, Leanne. My pleasure.
So talk to us about why is it that Sakelege has now entered the farming arena?
Yeah, Sakelege has experience in a wide range of industries. Our mission is to secure a flourishing economic order. And in various court cases and litigation processes over the years, we've learned some lessons about how government and failure by ministers and state officials to do their job can obstruct private solutions to problems. And there's a tendency in government to delay and to centralize. Earlier this year, we realized that the foot and mouth disease crisis, the outbreak, was reached significant proportions. The minister even said that he wanted to declare a national state of disaster. And we were approached by several industry bodies and farmers and veterinarians and others. And so we decided, well, let's see if we can help. And we identified a certain key problem, which seems to be that the Minister of Agriculture insists that only the state may procure and have vaccines administered. And we then went and had a look at what is the basis for this claim, and we couldn't find it. And so far, the minister has failed to provide it.
Yeah. So this is a devastating story at this point in time. And it really isn't just a veterinary problem. It's now turning into food security and an economic problem, which we really do see. I mean, we see the prices of meat increasing and the issues that farmers are having to deal with. So if we get into this situation now, you've actually instructed the attorneys to approach the courts to review and set aside the ban. Why is this?
Well, anything of this magnitude, the state professes to be able to handle alone. And after many years of failure, including 18 months of failure to solve this problem under Minister Steenhuisen's tenure, we don't want to put more faith in government, especially not now that the plan is to vaccinate 14 million cattle. So we now want to say, let's have a dual-stream approach. The Minister and the Department of Agriculture can continue with what they've been promising to do for many years, but have failed to do. We're not trying to stop them from doing something. But what we are doing is we're saying he must show us the legal basis for preventing private parties, veterinarians and farmers and so on, from procuring, that is buying licensed vaccines in South Africa and administering those. This is common under state-controlled diseases of other sorts, for example, Newcastle disease or brucellosis or other vaccines. It's true that this thing are called foot-and-mouth disease is a state-controlled disease. The state has classified it as such. But there are dozens of such diseases in South Africa, and they're all treated very differently. Mm-hmm. Minister Steenhuisen somehow has decided rather to obstruct clarity, to obstruct us, and to obstruct private parties seeking to secure vaccines by failing to provide a legal basis. He keeps refusing to tie himself down to a version of his supposed legal basis for the specific way in which he wants to control this state-controlled disease.
Yeah. So, I mean, do you agree that foot and mouth disease is officially a state-controlled disease? Obviously, you know, this is. But if so, what is at the heart of this conflict?
Well, officially, it is called a state-controlled disease because the state classified it as such.
Yeah.
In practice, it is a disease out of control because the state does not provide adequate regulations and it obstructs private parties from solving the disease and intervening to save their production losses. So in practice, it's out of control. This Minister Steenhuisen keeps calling it a state-controlled disease. It is classified as such. And he fails to provide a legal basis. This makes it very difficult now, because if he had last week complied with our demands, we sent him a formal letter, because it's not an informal matter. It's a formal matter. Many millions and billions of rands are at stake. So we sent him a formal letter saying, give us your reasons. And he keeps making vague public statements. He refuses to engage with us. He refuses to reply. And now the only way to proceed is to do this through litigation. We want to get the minister to tie himself down to a version of his argument, and then we can engage on that. Because maybe, I mean, at this stage, it looks like the minister is the problem. But maybe he isn't. Maybe it's the act. Maybe it's the regulations. But the minister doesn't want to provide us a basis for formal engagement.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that to argue for the state side, because they basically are saying that they want to, you know, control the vaccine process. They feel that if it's uncontrolled, it can undermine disease surveillance, confuse international trading partners, delay regaining export status. They also warn that there could be illegal vaccine imports, incorrect vaccine strains being used, a lack of a cold chain control. These are some of the reasons that they are giving. Clearly, you don't think these are good enough reasons.
Well, where does he give these reasons? He never ties himself down to a version. We're precisely asking him to tie himself down to a version, give us the reasons, the legal basis for his prohibition on private vaccine procurement and private vaccine administration. And it's especially important because in many other state-controlled diseases, with medical substances and veterinary substances of even of much more severe human risk, veterinarians are buying and applying, private parties are buying and applying the vaccines, administering it themselves. So Minister Steenhuisen really in media statements or in public statements, he keep offering reasons, but his reasons keeps changing. He even introduces things like bioterrorism and such. I'll tell you what a bioterrorist is. Is a infected cow. You can just extract the infected material from the cow, take it anywhere in the world, and infect other cows. Mm. As opposed to the vaccines suggested, which do not have pose the same risk. So Minister Sienhuysen just keeps making up arguments. We'd like him to provide one in writing.
So, I mean, obviously, is there adequate communication from the department to you? I mean, is that you're saying that there isn't like a, you know, enough communication in terms of the reasoning behind all of this? Do you feel that there's been enough communication from the department?
But let's move on to other areas where the government of South Africa has moved to close digital divide in South African schools.
Tshepeni Secondary School are set to benefit from a fully equipped Microsoft Digital Laboratory aimed at improving digital literacy and strengthening teaching and learning outcomes.
Minister Malatsi and I are on a mission to essentially, on his side, to place a device in every learner, but also to working with our companies so that we can make sure that we really roll out internet access to many more schools. It mustn't matter that your school is either in a township or in a rural area. You must be able to have access, and that is why we are on this drive. We've started it last year, and we continue to work together as the two departments to make sure that, in fact, not only do we have devices, but we also have internet access, particularly for poor black children who otherwise would not have it if we don't make a concerted effort to do so.
The digital lab is expected to enhance learning in key subjects such as science and mathematics while giving learners access to tools that many do not have at home.
I, as a science learner, am also very excited and can't wait to try out our new technology as AI is now taking over the world. With the correct data, school tasks and projects will be easily done and finished quickly because most learners in this school do not have the right equipment and resources in their homes to help them finish tasks, which leads to unfinished projects.
The initiative is a partnership between government, Microsoft, and community organizations aimed at accelerating digital transformation in public education.
Government won't always and doesn't have the resources to meet the needs of our population, right? So you've got players in the space, such as businesses like Microsoft, Tamitech, and non-governmental organizations like Josie My Josie, who have the resources and the time and are passionate about community development. So when you have all these three players coming together, it plants a great seed that will benefit the learners in this area. And it is through the power of partnerships that today here in Soweto, here at this school, you've got a world-class lab.
Government says the handover highlighted commitment to ensuring that learners, regardless of where they come from, are digitally empowered and ready to compete in a modern economy. For SABC News, I'm Luyanda Dang in Soweto.
Meanwhile, from Zambia, many children struggle with reading and writing. Let's take a listen.
Imagine seeing letters clearly, but still struggling to read or write. For many living with dyslexia, this is the reality. We take a closer look at what it is and how it affects daily life. Picture this. Two children looking at the same page, but not being on the same page. Excuse the pun, but this is possible because for many children, learning to read comes naturally, but for others, letters and words on a page don't always make sense. This is due to dyslexia, which is a learning disability that disrupts how one's brain processes written language.
Dyslexia basically is a condition where individuals have problems recognizing written text or reading written language. And so, like you can guess from the word, so there's this, which means bad or mal. And lexia has got to do with identification of words or vocabulary. And so dyslexia basically it's a condition, an innate, an inborn condition that individuals have, certain individuals have, and they have problems reading.
According to Dr. Happy Zulu, in Zambia, many children with dyslexia go unnoticed for years, even though early signs may appear in the first years of schooling.
So it's Certainly beyond poor reading, because poor reading is something that, many people have that problem where even in school they may have problems reading, but dyslexia, when it's been diagnosed to be dyslexia, these individuals have a problem. Their brain has a problem processing. They have an issue processing written text. And so even if they try, it may be a very big challenge for them to read over a prolonged period of time.
When dyslexia is not identified early, the impact can extend beyond academics. Specialists warn that repeated struggles in class can affect a child's confidence, self-esteem, and emotional well-being, especially when they are labeled as careless or disruptive.
This problem is identified from between age 5 to age 7. And as you may notice, this is a time when these children are exposed in the school environment where they're expected to read. And so usually it's at that point. So the most common signs is where you have a persistent issue of an individual failing to read or struggling to read. And so at some point, of course, after repeated efforts to help this individual, they may still find themselves struggling to read even just a few words or just a single paragraph. And so what happens is that it has an effect on their self-esteem, and you find that they try to avoid or try to, by all means, to avoid tasks which will require them to read. And so when you identify that this is persistent, it could be something that parents or teachers or guardians may need to maybe seek intervention from a psychologist or neuropsychologist, or even teachers that are trained to handle these children with special cases.
There is also a common belief that dyslexia is linked to low intelligence. Experts say this is a misconception, stressing that many children with dyslexia are bright and capable, but learn differently. With the right support, both at home and in school, children with dyslexia can improve their reading skills, stay engaged in class, and succeed academically. Even when diagnosis happens later, intervention can still make a meaningful difference.
So what is key is to support, and it might not only be dyslexia, for any issues that, especially for children that they may have, it's important that we are able to support them emotionally. We are able to support them with probably an instruction design or a structured way of learning which will benefit them, which might not be the usual kind of learning like everybody else. The good news is that interventions can be done at whatever level, and it's not only for children. There are some adults that have an issue with dyslexia. It's just that probably at that point they may choose to get into career paths or tasks that might not require them to be reading or processing written text.
As awareness grows, parents and teachers are being encouraged to pay closer attention to learning challenges, ask the right questions, and seek professional guidance early. Leila Rashida.
Meanwhile, Tanzania authorities dismiss claims on new SGR under unusual strain.
Since its launch in June 2024, Tanzania's Standard Gauge Railway has transported more than 4.3 million passengers. Many commuters now depend on the four-hour journey between Dar es Salaam and the capital Dodoma, a trip that previously took up to 8 hours by road. Until recently, operations had remained largely smooth before erratic weather conditions forced a temporary suspension of services.
Even major airlines in developed countries postpone flights when there are strong winds or heavy rains. This is not unusual. I want to make it clear to the Tanzania Railway Corporation that the lives of Tanzanians comes first. Safety must always be the top priority. It is better for a journey to be postponed than for people to travel when their safety cannot be guaranteed.
Tanzania's Railway Authority has dismissed claims that the recent damage was caused by design or construction flaws, saying instead that the disruption resulted from erosion along riverbanks near the rail corridor. Officials insist the SGR was built to withstand extreme weather, featuring reinforced embankments, improved drainage systems, and durable culverts designed to manage heavy water flows during intense rainfall. and ensuring the line can run smoothly is vital for future growth.
For the government, the port of Dar es Salaam remains central to expanding both the scale and efficiency of the standard gauge railway. Currently handling about 28 million tons of cargo annually, authorities plan to increase that figure to 30 million tons by 2030. The envisioned 2,000 kilometer SGR network is expected to serve as a high-capacity transport corridor to boost regional trade across East Africa.
The government says it is finalizing key works to integrate the railway directly with port operations in Dar es Salaam.
Once completed, this project will increase container handling efficiency to about 480,000 units per year and raise rail freight transportation from the current 2% to approximately 12%.
Despite funding constraints and climate-related disruptions, the government says it remains committed to extending the railway to Burundi. Last year, Tanzania signed a $2 billion contract with China Railway Engineering Group to undertake the construction over a six-year period. Officials believe the expanded network will significantly enhance trade flows and strengthen economic integration across East Africa. Isaac Lukando, CGTN, Dar es Salaam.
Meanwhile, British Council and UNESCO funding rebirth of Sudan's port town.
Once known as the White City, Suakin attracted tourists who flocked here to see its unique ancient buildings and architectural designs made of coral stone taken from the seabed. The port embodied the rich cultural heritage of the Artega tribe, part of Eastern Sudan's Beja ethnic group. For centuries, Suakin served as a transit point for merchant caravans and Muslim and Christian pilgrims traveling to Mecca and Jerusalem.
The town had the first port during the Ottoman era, and all houses were built with three floors during that period. These buildings witnessed various types of colonialism, whether British or Egyptian.
In 2017, then-Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir granted the port to the Turkish government under a 99-year lease for tourist development. In 2019, the restoration journey stalled after Bashir was overthrown. But since, the British Council and UNESCO have stepped in.
When we finish the restoration, the tourists can come here and also share and invite other people to come here. So the place itself is a historic building, a tourist place for the tourists also. They can come and see the Sufi songs and music using drums. So it is a good place for the tourists to come here after we finish restoration, maybe after 5 or 4 months since now.
We keep the heritage of this city special, Suakin, because the architecture of this city is have most amazing architecture and decorations in all of the city. So we work hard for keep all this.
Currently, Sudanese transport company Tarko operates daily crossings, carrying around 200 passengers per trip from the modern port of Suakin within sight of the ancient city and its decaying environs. Wilkis Anyabwa, CGTN.
And with that, we have officially come to the conclusion of today's episode of On the Reader News Analysis. Do stay tuned for the Onkonana Nadenge program brought to you by Louis Ashimi. Don't forget to tune in for the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut from 16:30 and the Business Economic segment with David Shombe from 1800 hours. Now from Indafa, happy as usual, it is goodbye. I'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place. And it is adios. Ciao, ciao.